Hey everybody, welcome back to the Back Porch Education Podcast, an ongoing conversation about why and how we ought to educate ourselves and those we love. This is Season 2, Episode 1. A conversation where we ask, can you compel a student to learn, and should you? Enjoy the show. Good evening, good morning, good afternoon. I'm Jason here with my co-host, Robert Frost. And we also have Steve joining us today. Steve, what's up?
Yeah, I get some, I get a footnote anyway. Very good. Yeah. I wanted to remind you that poetry is a long and distinguished art, and many have practiced it. Robert Frost, a good man, but.
Yeah.
Wouldn't be.
Are you telling me there are other good poets?
Yeah. Pass the love around a little bit. You know. Yeah, I know you're still mad at me for bringing up Bono a while back, but between Bono and Frost, there's a few others out there that we can stand.
Yeah, we don't want to exclude anybody. I'm just not done with Frost yet. His stuff is so it's really compelling to me. Not to front load what we're doing here, but okay, let me do it. But this one, I've got to say, I don't have my book in front of me. I'm doing it from memory. So if it's wrong, whoops. But this one is called Something for Hope. And it ends, I got to say this, the last line, there's a little bit of Latin, but don't be scared by it. It's Spes alita Greek olam. And it's a Latin proverb that means hope nourishes the farmer. Okay. So that's where I'm headed. That's the last line. All right. So here we go. Something for hope. At the present rate, it should come to pass, and that right soon, that the meadow sweet and steeple bush, not good to eat, will have crowded out the edible grass. Then all there is to do is wait for maple, birch, and spruce to push through meadow sweet and steeple bush and crowd them out at a similar rate. No plow among these rocks would pay. So busy yourself with other things while the trees put on their wooden rings and with long-sleeved branches hold their sway. Cut down the trees when lumber's grown, and there's your pristine earth all freed from lovely blooming but wasteful weed and ready again for the grass to own. A cycle will say of 100 years. Thus foresight does it, and laissez-faire, a virtue in which we all may share, unless a government interferes. Patience and looking away ahead and leaving some things to take their course. Hope may not nourish a cow or horse, but Spes alita Greek olam, 'tis said.
Well, that's
okay. So you like the government line, yeah. Steve.
Sorry.
But no, it's good.
I couldn't resist. There was awesome. Sublime moment there when my vocative foresight had to come forth. So the last line is the kick, though, right?
Absolutely.
Cows and horses don't know much about hope, but the farmer sure does.
Yep. And that is his sustenance.
We want to talk a little bit about horses. Yep. We've set aside this particular episode for the question, can you compel a student to learn? Which could be shaded a little differently by asking, can you make a horse drink water? Right. And it's my job to kind of start us off today with a brief history of compulsory schooling. We do compel students to go to school.
Yes.
We could talk about whether or not that's the same as compelling them to learn or not, but,
right. Yeah.
We good. We do make them, and I honestly don't know. I know it's a state by state issue. There is no federal, law in place. I say, I think it's pretty standardized across the states these days that at least until the age of 16, the government, by use of law enforcement, says parents are responsible for making sure their children are in school. Now, of course, that can be public, private, or even homeschool, but it is a compulsory requirement that comes from the mid-19th century. And, you know, I, from my point of view, there's a lot happening in an education in the 19th century that kind of caused us to change how we behaved. For a long time in the West, education focused, as it were, as we often say here on the show, focused on wisdom and virtue. It didn't feel compulsion was necessary. Its own reward made most want it. And I hear all kinds of nonsense on a regular basis about how compulsory education had to come into play because there was just horribly high rates of illiteracy and all kinds of things. Ooh. You know, the prior to mass schooling, there was very few educational options and that sort of thing. And it's just not historically accurate. You read any decent history of our early American experience, I see rates as high as 3/4 of the total U.S. population, including slaves, being literate.
Wow.
And
that's mid-19th, you said? 1800s?
Yeah. Before compulsory education.
Wow. That's good to know.
Yeah. In the website, I'll post a link to an article that kind of brings some of this forth. But the compelling reason for compulsion seems to have come from the massive wave of immigration in the early to mid 1800s. If you know your history, a large number of immigrants came escaping the Great Famine in Europe, potato famine as it's often called. My own ancestors came to America through that directly.
Wow.
And there was just sort of this threatening of the status quo, right? Many of the immigrants were Irish Catholics, and the predominantly Anglo-Saxon Protestant public schooling, anyway. I'll read you a quote from the editor of the Massachusetts Teacher. Now, Massachusetts is important because it's the first state to go with compulsory education. You can find some states holding out on into the 1900s, but 1851 1852 is when they passed the law. But here in 1851, the William Swan wrote, "In too many instances, the parents, speaking of the immigrants, are unfit guardians of their own children. If left to their direction, the young will be brought up in idle, dissolute, vagrant habits, which will make them worse members of society than their parents are. Instead of filling our public schools, they will find their way into our prisons, houses of correction, and almshouses. Nothing can operate effectually here but stringent legislation, thoroughly carried out by an efficient police. The children must be gathered up and forced into school. And those who resist or impede this plan, whether parents or priests, must be held accountable and punished."
Oh, boy.
Now, I'm not saying that that guy by himself won the argument, but that's the kind of argument that was being put forth. If we don't do something, we're going to be left behind. Keep in mind that 1850s and 60s is the rise of the view of progressivism, the notion that we are becoming better and better, and it's mostly through the use of expert opinion that we can steer society towards a better place. Horace Mann, Horace Mann's a big guy with this, and he has those statements out there, very clearly states that prisons and schools are interrelated. If you have more schools, you'll have less prisons, or vice versa. And of course, we've got plenty of schools these days.
Plenty.
Prisons seem to be overcrowded.
And as a result, we don't have any prisons anymore. Yeah.
Well, one could argue that the schools themselves feel more like prisons than maybe they should. But that's right? that's the problem, as best as I can state it, as short as I can state it. We are in a place today where we make students go to school. And I'm not suggesting that we can change that fact. I'm asking what its effect is on education.
Yeah, that's that. I think that's a more interesting question. Like, sort of, we can pontificate about, well, let's change everything in the whole United States. And we can feel really good about ourselves doing that. But I think it's better, or just more interesting to me anyway, to sort of look carefully at what has happened and then say, what is happening now as a result of that? Like, what society is our society creating?
Right. And right? I mean, guys like Thomas Jefferson, of course, pushed on us the notion that a fully literate, educated nation is all the only hope we had to sustain any kind of a democratic society. Mm-hmm. Voters have to know enough to vote well. His famous quote, if a nation expects to be ignorant and free in a state of civilization, it expects what never was and never will be. Freedom and education are tied at the hip, I guess is the way to put it.
Right. Yeah. Well, I might even say freedom and education, what's the difference?
Right. Exactly.
You know, and of course there are differences, Jason. Come on, get off your high horse. But I almost want to stick to it and say, no, they really are sort of linked. And so I like Jefferson. I like that you brought up Jefferson, because I think that, whether or not it ended up working out well, the democratic notion, America certainly was an interesting experiment, right? And the notion that people should have the opportunity to be educated and informed, and somehow that made them able to be good citizens, I think that's laudable.
Yes.
By the time we get to the 1850s and we have our boy from Massachusetts there, I don't like that anymore. The way that it's, you know, progressed.
Well, and I,
but that old notion, you know, I think, wow, that's something pretty powerful.
Well, so we have a couple of questions that I think turn this from just a historical discussion to a practical concept. Should you compel education? And once we've talked about that, can you compel education? Let's pick those up.
Yeah. Okay, Steve. So should you compel a student to learn? Can you compel a student to learn? I want to take, can you compel first? Because I think the answer is pretty easy, right? Like, it allows me access into the heart of the matter faster, perhaps.
Yeah.
At least in my mind, because I want to say, like, straight out, can you compel a student to learn? Yeah, of course you can. Of course. It's not hard at all. You just get a big stick and you scare them, right? Like, yeah. Of course you can teach an unwilling student some things, right? You can teach somebody how to throw a baseball. You can teach somebody the alphabet. You can teach someone, what year the Civil War started, all the major battles of the Civil War. You know, like, you can teach these sorts of things, and you, the question isn't teach. Can you compel them to learn? Yes, you can compel them to learn those things, those skills, or those facts.
And
so,
the compulsion then is either external in sort of a behaviorist carrot and stick. And the carrot is probably used just as much as, or these days more than the stick, right? The carrot being the great job, the big paycheck, the power.
The good life. Yeah. Exactly. Well, yeah. I mean, as soon as I say good life, I want to take it back, because I want
to
reserve that. But that is what's dangled anyway, right? Sort of, you will have the sports car, the big house, and the season tickets to the Blues games if you
do this. Right. But that's where the problem comes in as well, right? As long as it's external, it's temporary. Right. I've had this conversation with a number of teachers who reflect behaviorist discipline in the classroom. Look, you know, a famous story of when I was a principal for a while, I inherited a teacher who told her fifth grade students, if you're well behaved Monday through Thursday, I'll bring you in French fries from McDonald's on Friday.
Oh, and, boy.
And that worked wonderfully for I don't know, probably 2 months.
Oh, I mean, imagine
sitting there munching on some wonderful McDonald's. And please, listeners, don't judge me on, I know what McDonald's fries are. She did too, but she knew that it was a very steamy carrot. You know what I mean?
Yes, the absolutely.
Kids wanted it until they didn't. Until things like, I remember some of the questions started popping up. Well, how come we only get a small? Or how come it has to be McDonald's? Why not? I like Wendy's fries better. Why not a cheeseburger next week, et cetera? So it was temporary.
Those are all good questions. Those are all fair questions that the students are asking, right? Like sort of, well, if you're going to give me a carrot, if this is the transaction, then I want to choose the carrot.
Right. Let's negotiate. Yeah. Right. And my own sons, who from time to time, in some form or another, had to consider the stick for their motivation.
Sure.
Would negotiate as well. You know, so behaviorism is external.
Yeah.
And as a result, that's its problem. What we're hoping for is that at some point, by perhaps using external motivation, offering, for instance, which you wanted to take back when you heard yourself say it, offering the good life to a student, at some point, his own loves, his own desires have to embrace, in this case, learning.
Yeah.
In order to get there, he's not going to get there. At least I don't think he's going to get all the way home and have a true education until his own loves are changed.
Yeah.
So I think in almost anything in life, we are under God's law to compel young ones to love the right things. But the horse and water issue is I could drown a horse in water.
Absolutely.
But he's got to swallow.
Yep.
Right. Before it's really drinking.
Right.
So, and I know there's all the ways to manipulate that. Say I can shove a tube down his throat and so on and so forth, which really break down when we're using it as an analogy for education.
Absolutely.
But that there was some of that in the quote from the 1851 guy.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I don't think parents are doing enough. So we need to grab this thing and make it happen.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so I think that what you just said, that's where I was going to go with sort of the way that that horse and water metaphor is often used, right? Like, and maybe even abused and manipulated and changed in an effort to sort of describe what education is. In the same way that the sort of teach a man to fish, give a man a fish thing is used, right? And each of those, what do you want to call them, proverbs, have they have a sort of kernel of truth in them, but I think they're also, they can be just as misleading as they are helpful when misapplied.
Right.
So yeah, the issue, I mean, I guess I'm sort of in search of other metaphors. Like, is education the process of leading a horse to water? Like, is that even what learning is, being led to water? I mean, in a certain way, that sounds nice. But then again... there is this component of the student. And it seems to me, you said something about the loves, you know, sort of a student's development of their loves. And I think that is really what's at the heart of education, right? Like it's a formation of a person's loves,
yep.
what they love, and the order of things, like the way that they order things, or sort of priorities, right? Like, so I don't know. I'm looking for other metaphors now. I don't want to lead horses to water anymore,
yep.
right? Like I want the teacher to be, I really want to come up with a super awesome farming metaphor on the spot, but I don't. I'm actually thinking of painting, right? Sort of like, can I paint a picture beautiful enough that the audience or that the viewer recognizes it and is drawn to it?
Yep, yep. Well, so paint it well enough that it becomes real. You've just stumbled into the metaphor.
That they want to live in it.
I don't know if you're familiar with the short story that Tolkien wrote, Leif by Niggle.
Okay, you mentioned this on the podcast before. Shame on all the listeners who did not go out and look at it. Also, shame on me because I did not look at it.
Well, I see. But I don't remember. This is this is the back porch, man. I forget.
Yeah, but, no, tell me again because I don't.
So,
remember.
So just taking the metaphor that you just gave of painting something so well that it becomes real, is or at mm-hmm. least. At least captures the imagination of the observer. Niggle is an artist and he's painting this scene and he never gets beyond the leaves on a tree. Mm. And so he feels like he's, you know, his whole life, he keeps getting distracted by other things, by a neighbor whose roof needs to be helped. And this crisis over here and et cetera. And he cares. And so he goes and he deals with it and gets back to the painting and I'm never going to complete this. But then you're transported to the next life and he's walking in a garden with some angels and he sees this beautiful tree and he's like, those leaves are amazing. And the angel's like, well, of course they are. You drew them.
Huh.
And I mean, that is an interesting, the artistic metaphor is an interesting route to go. I would also put out there that we've developed a metaphor quite thoroughly that isn't ours, but Plato had this whole notion of a cave mm-hmm. that I find to be pretty compelling as a metaphor of education and maybe much more so than the horse and water, because he even wrestles with the fact that once the guy is out in the real light of truth and attempts to go back in and get others to come, teacher and student relationship there, mm-hmm. they're less than mm-hmm. excited about the notion of getting unchained and taken out into the sun.
That's
leave
right.
me alone. I'm happy here.
Well, he's talking crazy, right? Like that to me is education. Like that is the quintessential sort of role of the teacher is you like, that's what requires boldness of us as teachers. You are yep. talking crazy. Like it doesn't make any sense. The students, well, I think anyway, if I'm painting a picture of the good life, because to the degree that my students do not see the good life the way that I see it, they think that I'm wrong and they think that I'm a madman. So, you know, it's that sort of willingness to look silly, to look crazy. And it's this boldness that there's the boldness that is required of teachers to sort of stick to it and say, guys, girls, really, this is the good life. Like, this is what we're after. Wisdom and virtue are this way. And sort of work through it that, like, in that way so that they can hear it long enough to be persuaded.
You can compel a student to learn. it's what compels them.
Right.
That's the key.
Right.
Yeah. What is the compulsion being used? Is it an efficient police force?
Yeah. what a scary phrase, by the way.
Yeah. Truth and goodness and beauty and et cetera. I want to develop this a little bit more and also go on into possible ways this gets answered.
Yeah.
And what we think of that.
Good.
I want to jump right back in and tell a story. You mentioned, Jason, about this whole issue of loving the right things or loving the higher things.
Mm-hmm.
I was at a group of educators sitting around in a hotel lobby. We had some time to kill before lunch was ready, maybe as much as 20 minutes. And so one of the more A-type personalities in the group said, hey, we'll play a game. Here's the game. You have to define education in one sentence.
Okay.
Go. And the first guy to open his mouth is the only one who ever got to answer because his answer was so compelling that we all spent the rest of the 20 minutes arguing about it. And his simple answer was the raising of taste.
Mm, okay.
And he just sat back in his chair and looked at us and says, who wants to challenge that? and that's what we're talking about, right? So much of what we're trying to do as educators is simply say, yeah, you're this far in, and it, and especially I teach middle school, high school level students. There's a lot of sophomoric notion in them.
Absolutely.
What more should I need to learn? I've already passed the test on this.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to convince them, they hear me say it a lot, that the best learning is when there's more questions at the end than the beginning. And
right.
that the deeper and further up in you go, the more internally motivated the study becomes. I guess another quick story from college was sort of forced into a class that I did not want to take, but my schedule, I needed an elective in this field, and the only one available was one that just sounded horrible to me. And I kind of fussed, and by this point I was married, and so my wife heard some, why do I have to take this? And I wish I could pay somebody to take it for me. So I come back after the first class. She says, so was it as bad as you thought? And I said, we've now got to subscribe to this magazine. We're dirt poor newlyweds with me in college.
Uh-huh.
We've got to go buy this expensive magazine because I'm so fascinated by this subject. I now want to know everything there is to know about it.
Wow.
And it was the teacher who, knowing his students, found a way to dangle, if you want to say it this way, a carrot in front of us. You will be so much better for knowing this in what you are intended to do in life than if you didn't know it, that I'm just here to kind of open the door and kick you through it. You're going to want to study this the rest of your life. And I wrote one of my best papers of college, came out of that class. I rushed into class to get a good seat, et cetera. And it was because that teacher understood how important it was for us to love the subject before really being able to get anywhere with it. Because I think he knew that most people viewed that subject as, and he'd heard it enough that he had decided, okay, I got to sell this. I got to get the kid into it, or it's just not going to happen. And that's worked its way up in so many lessons in my teaching experience that the introduction, especially I teach English. Okay. That's mostly what I teach. And
we speak English. Why do I need this class?
Why do I need the class? And often the books I'm asking them to read, you know, when a student asked me one time, when are we going to read anything relevant? And when I asked her for an example, she gave some modern YA, you know, young adult, on the edge of being porn, I'm like, there's nothing more irrelevant to you.
Right.
You need something that calls you back away from there, not moves you towards it. So, I think that you can compel a student, but that what you want is for the compulsion as quickly as possible to become their own. If that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think that's right. That, I mean, I think basically, well, okay. Not all educators would agree that you, want to put like that you want the student to be intrinsically motivated instead of extrinsically motivated. But I would think that at least almost all of them would agree, right? So you have sort of the, well, just leave them, right? Yeah. Like just leave the child behind philosophy, if you will, yep. Right? That says, well, hey, look, if the kid's not going to learn it, who cares? Just move on.
It's their choice and the consequences are up to them.
Yep. Right. Right. So I guess maybe they would say, well, but I think even that strategy or idea philosophy would say we want our students to want to learn.
Yeah, we wish we could compel them, but we don't think we can.
Yeah, right, exactly.
And then I think that there's that notion out there that only some are capable of.
That's, you know, yes,
and
you're right.
I know as soon as I say that, that smacks of elitism. It's exactly what Jefferson was pushing against, even though he's gotten a pretty aristocratic education. He was saying, look, this representative democracy can't work if only a few people have the stuff necessary to govern. That at the heart of a good democracy is self-government, which seems to have a lot to do with wisdom and virtue. Right. We've got to build up a populace that govern themselves, or we're going to need a police state. We're going to need a monarchy, right? Or some form of power in play to make them do what they ought to be doing because they haven't learned to do it themselves. And I'm not arguing. Please don't take this 30 minutes of conversation on our back porch as, you know, Steve's plea for a return to some sort of elitist, only some are good enough to be educated. I do not believe that.
Right.
But I do believe that no amount of making kids show up at school is going to guarantee more than, well, we've put them in the location where learning hopefully is occurring.
Yes.
But making them learn itself is a whole different bottle of wax than having a police officer escort them to school.
Right.
You know, that sort of thing.
Well, and so this is exactly where you started. This was like the first thing you said, right? Was you started sort of like off the cuff. You didn't even chase it down, but I thought, oh man, he hit it right there. When you said, can you compel a student to learn? Well, you can compel them to go to school, right? And so right away you drew a distinction between schooling and learning, basically schooling and education. And yeah, I think that's right. That to the extent that we say that those are the same thing, school and education, we do ourselves a disservice because one can be compelled and the other, I actually should, dare I say, I want to say that it really can't be. Right, that liberation can't be compelled.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going with it. Here's where I'm thinking now. Earlier, I said freedom and education. What's the difference? Well, how do you compel someone to liberation, to freedom? Yeah, right. Like, get yourself free. Get free. Get free. Well, they can't. Not if you're yelling at them the whole time. That's not freedom.
There's some things just not in the power of one human to do to another.
Yeah.
And that's frost, right? Now we're back. No plow among these rocks would pay.
That's right.
So busy yourself with other things while the trees put on their wooden rings, right? Mm-hmm. The good, the true, and the beautiful will win.
Yeah.
I don't know how else to put it to especially fearful teachers. But they're just not learning, or they're not paying attention, or I can't get them to learn. You know, all these frustrations that, especially along about March or April, really kind of, you know, come to the forefront. And I hear it all the time. Homeschool parents, you know, there's just so much baggage. They're my own children, and we got all this. I understand, but it will work. Not because you force it, not with power, but with love.
That's there's exactly.
The point. There it is.
Yep. Yeah. And so everybody hop on. It's scary, right? It's a wild ride. And it's not without danger. It's just sort of going back over the history of education. This is just the surest road that we know, right? Yep. That the way to set someone free or to teach them to live freely, to liberate someone and to let them be educated is to sort of model freedom for them, let them practice it and sort of like charge them and encourage them within that. But I don't know, not with a carrot, not with a stick, nearly as much as sort of with a calm voice, right? I mean, I think of
within
I think
this
of
room,
another, yeah.
Yeah, within this room, we're free. And I think they right. you get to where they run to the room, right?
Yeah.
Sort of what I was talking about with the one college professor that.
That's right.
Build a place where I wanted to be. And I think that's one of the most effective things teachers can do is make you want to come back for more. Make you kind of fuss, oh, the bell rang. As opposed to many of my students, you know exactly when the bell's going to ring and can't wait to go.
Right. So you hear the notebook slam and the zippers start going 30 seconds. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Or 5 minutes, depending on how boring you're being that day.
Well, I was just being jealous of you when you said 30 seconds. I wasn't going to ring that up.
Right. That's good. Well, guys, it's working. My plan is working. Steve is referencing Robert Frost in his arguments. So the slow imprint of the sign on the wax is taking hold.
Stay tuned.
We're having a good time.
Yeah. Stay tuned. Jason will soon be quoting U2 lyrics. So.
Good stuff. All right, Steve. Well, I think that's enough for today. But good talking, man.
Good talking. We'll talk to you again.